Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Okay, Ben, part two in our motorsports editions. We're in the air last week with Matty Hall. This week, we're on the ground. Do you like motorsports?
No.
Do you like team sports?
I'm pretty renowned for not being a big sports guy. Although, I am coming around to AFL through my children.
Mm-hmm.
When I say I don't like it, I'm not the sit on the couch all Saturday watching sports sort of guy. However, I can definitely appreciate the skill involved in both team and individual sports.
Do you like things going fast?
Yeah.
Do you like individual sports?
Yeah.
Then this one is for you?
Well, is it? Well, I reckon our guest might challenge you on whether this is an individual or a team sport, Tim.
That's excellent. Now, our guest is Jessica Dane. Jessica is a force for women in motorsports, Ben. She's the granddaughter of one of the founding members of the British Special Air Service, the SAS, and the daughter of Roland Dane. And she's currently forging her own career and ignoring all doubters and all critics.
Mm.
Now, interestingly, she started her motorsports career in the gearbox shop, being a sub-assembly mechanic. She then moved through marketing, media, and PR roles in Red Bull Holden Racing Team. And now she's in a commercial role. She talks about the franchise, the team, and its leadership, to your point. She also talks about gender disparity. And interestingly, she's recently been appointed the chairperson of the Australian Women in Motorsports Commission, which has been designed to provide a voice for women in motorsport. And not being content with all that, Ben, she's also studying law.
What does she do in her spare time?
CrossFit.
good answer.
Her insights in this episode are absolutely inspiring. I love a phrase that I'm going to give a sneak preview on. When we ask her about her myriad of challenges that she has previously confronted and is currently confronting, she says, and I quote, "I don't think there was ever anything I thought I couldn't do." I think we'll just leave you with that. Let's get on with the show. Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
And Ben, we are joined today by Jessica Dane, and we've done Jess's intro. Jess, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
No, thanks for being on the program. And where we thought we might start, Jess, is a little bit about your background. You have an unusual accent, so clearly you were not born and raised in southeast Queensland.
I'm not, no. I did get my Aussie passport last year, though, so I'm fully fledged Australian these days and have been for about a year or so. But I'm English. I grew up in Surrey, rolling countryside hills. I'm very much a country girl. I came over to Australia for the first time the second time, because I came on holiday when I was eight, but came over properly in 2008. And I started working with the Supercars motorsport team that I'm still with now. And that was when I was 18, and I started as a mechanic. And I did that for 6 months or so on my gap year before I went back to England to study journalism. And did 3 years at uni in Bournemouth, which God knows how I got a degree, because I kept coming back to Australia while I was supposed to be in lectures, but somehow I still managed to pass. So as soon as I graduated, got back on a plane and moved back to Australia, this time as a resident, which is 2012 now. And I've been working in motorsport ever since in various roles, plus a stint, 6 month stint in TV production, where during that time I thought, oh, I'll give something else a go. I'll try and I'll challenge myself, take myself out of the comfort zone of racing. And I realized that I'm far too competitive to do anything other than trying to beat other people in some way. So that taught me a lot about myself. And then fast forward to 2019, we are now, and now I'm still working with the team. I became a shareholder of the team, Triple Eight Race Engineering, in 2015, And as well as working as commercial executive, so looking after our team partners, I'm also a law student.
Mm. Well, let's not fast forward too quickly. So you studied journalism, but I also understand that you had great desire to be an actor.
Yeah, that was my first career goal, I think you would call it. I was, I don't know if you'd call it outgoing, or yeah, I guess I was an outgoing kid, but I was creative in terms of I was always trying to imagine new worlds, whether that was through games or plays. I was always, all of my efforts were being channeled into being creative in a performing sense. And I think when I was a kid, I was called bossy a lot, but now people are more more sensitive to that and call it management skills these days. They don't tell young girls that they're bossy, they tell them they've got management skills, whereas I think I was just bossy.
It's funny, Tim and I talk about an element of theatre in leadership. You know, in many ways, while you want to be authentic, you want to be yourself, you also need to be cognizant of the fact that sometimes you're almost playing a role as a leader. You need to be aware that people are looking to you, and you need to sort of have that element, I guess, of acting in terms of being an inspirational leader. Do you find that the sort of acting philosophy, that sort of feel, comes through in your leadership in the business sense?
You talk theatre. I like to call it street theatre, because yeah, it's far more granular, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can completely see where that comes from. I wouldn't say that it's something that I've consciously noticed myself, but I can absolutely see how it does play a part, and it's probably a good way of looking at it, because, you know, when you're being a good leader, you're portraying an image that isn't necessarily something that might come naturally to you, but you're still having, in order to be a good leader and an effective leader, you're having to portray that image nevertheless. Sometimes all you might want to do in a situation is run and hide, or scream and shout, or whatever might feel most natural to you, but you're having to play a part by controlling all of those emotions and instincts and channeling them in a very different way in order to keep being effective as a leader.
Do you know, it's funny, I've been searching for a nice way of getting my head around that paradox of being yourself but also playing the part, and I think you've just nailed it. I love that idea of, you know, you're not being someone you're not, but you are, you know, avoiding your first instinct, which may be to curl up in the fetal position and sob in some cases. So it's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, excellent. I'm glad. I hope it's helpful.
And Jess, dwelling on your family a little bit, we talked over the last couple of days about your grandparents, both on the paternal and the maternal side. On the maternal side, John Graham, a well-decorated former member of the military who was influential in the Omani crisis, or the attempted coup in 1970. He was also a commanding officer of the 1st Battalion of the Parachute Regiment. I listened to an interview he gave at the Imperial War Museum some years ago, where he was talking about the World War II campaigns, and specifically in Northwest Europe, 1944 and 45. And he was asked the question, what are the duties of an intelligence officer? And very abruptly, he said, to look intelligent, of course, and to many, many guffaws. And at the end of the interview, he terminates it quite summarily by saying, I don't think I have anything more to say. To which the Imperial War Museum interviewer says, well, thank you very much. You know, you've been a fantastic guest. And your grandfather says, what a load of codswallop. Quite dismissive. That sort of self-deprecating piece from your maternal side, has that crossed over into any part of your genetic makeup?
I think my grandfather on my mother's side was many wonderful things, and one of the best things that he was eloquent. He could charm the socks off of anyone, and through his mannerisms, but mostly through his words. And I think his eloquence is certainly, or hopefully, I'd like to think, has passed down to me in some respects. And I'm lucky that on both sides of my family, you know, both sides of my family have a great way with words. But certainly having grown up with him is quite a big influence until he passed away in 2012 when I was 22. His writing, he was a prolific letter writer, and his writing and the heart and the feeling that he put into his words, whether they were spoken or written, has certainly had a major impact on the way that I portray myself in the way I write and speak.
Mm. And your father's father, David Dane, who yeah. was a pathologist and virologist and worked heavily and intensively on pioneering work against infectious diseases, was also, a little closer to our heart, one of the founding members of the British SAS.
Yes, he was.
And was involved in this incredible operation called Operation Bull Basket, which was a World War II mission to ambush German reinforcements heading for Normandy during the Allied invasion. And if my research is correct, there were about 40 of them who were originally, this is 40 British SAS as well as some French militia, about 40 of them involved in the operation, and 33 were captured and killed. An incredible book's been written on that called SAS Operation Bull Basket by Paul McHugh. But do you know much about your grandfather, David?
I've learnt more about him in recent years than I knew previously. He died when I was 7 years old, I think. And so I have most of my memories of him revolve around sitting at the kitchen table and seeing him pull out his shotgun over breakfast and shooting rabbits on the lawn, going down to feed the chickens and the ducks in the morning and being told profusely that the ones who had names wouldn't die, and inevitably they'd be on our table at lunchtime. And very, quite aggressive games of snap and being made for hours of cricket. So My memories of him are very much childhood ones, but I can see how much he had a very big influence on my sister, who's 5 years older than me. So she consequently knew him quite well and was his was also their first grandchild. So she had a very close relationship with them.
He must have had incredible grit, determination, and tenacity. I mean, reading the story of Bull Basket, where the core task of these very small group of SAS guys was to slow down the 2nd SS Panzer Division. Now, in those days, a Panzer Division was about 19,000 troops, not to mention God knows how many armoured vehicles, artillery pieces. And you can just imagine that initial orders group going to that small group of SAS guys saying, we just want you to slow down the SS Panzer Division. I think they were only about 2 days' drive away from Normandy, and to be a 40-man speed bump was essentially what they were going to do. Incredible tenacity. Does that cross over, the determination and tenacity component?
Yes, I think that's definitely something that that I can see has passed down through the generations as well. It's not something that I saw firsthand as a grandchild and a young grandchild, but the more that I've learned about him in recent years, and when I speak to my father about him, when we've had conversations about him in the past, it's certainly something that is very clear, and it's passed down to my father in a very different way. My father isn't involved in the military at all, but shows a tremendous amounts of grit and tenacity in his endeavours in business and motorsport over his 40 years in both industries. And I'd like to think that some of it is also rubbed off on my sister and me. But if you look back at what he's achieved, and especially talking to my grandmother about him when she was still alive, she passed away in 2011. Talking to her about him, she was, even however many years after he died, was still so full of awe of everything that he achieved and spoke of him so highly.
Mm. And talking about your father, Roland Dane, or RD, who clearly has been a tremendous influence in your life, because he moved out here, and I think you thought it was an extended business trip, but you later joined him. In his shadows, not in his shadows, what do you want to do differently to him?
Oh, good question. I have an awful lot of people in the supercars circle, actually in and out of the supercars circle, thinking that that the natural progression will be for me to take over the business. And I'm a co-shareholder of the business of 888 Race Engineering, but it's never put any pressure on me to follow a particular path, or apart from making me go to university in the first place, which when I was 18, I really didn't want to do. It's probably the only question he's put on me in that direction. But in terms of career and motorsport, it's always just been this opportunity is there if you want it. If not, go and do something else and make sure that whatever it is, you're successful. And I think that, you know, following in somebody's footsteps who is so defined in their own style of leadership is hard. And I think that if I do end up going down that route, something that would be important would be making sure that I don't try and replicate everything that he does and how he does it, because he is probably the only person in our entire establishment who could get away with leading in the way that he does, let's say.
Now, what people probably won't know is that when you first came to Australia, RD made you work sub-assembly, I think, in the gearbox shop of 888 Race Engineering. Is that right?
Yeah, I started as a sub-assembly mechanic. I wouldn't say made. He suggested it. I already I was coming out to Australia when I was 16, 17. And I remember we were on holiday in Ireland, and he thought that it would be quite entertaining in front of everyone who we're with to put me in a place and say, oh, by the way, when you're coming over to Australia, I'm going to put you in sub-assembly and you can get your hands a bit dirty. I thought, and I said, oh, that's excellent. I really wanted to do that. And he was taken aback. So I was extremely keen to get stuck into sub-assembly, and I've always been one for enjoying putting myself out of my comfort zone, as much as you can enjoy doing that, of course. And I don't think it was being made. I thoroughly enjoyed my time in sub-assembly, but just don't ask me to rebuild a transaxle these days.
Had you grown up with a spanner in your hand, Jess?
No, I grew up with a hoof pick in my hand. I grew up doing horses. So that meant that dirt under my nails was definitely nothing that was foreign to me by any means. And when I started in sub-assembly, I was the only girl on the workshop floor, and I had all the boys saying to me, oh, you know, what's it like having dirt and grease under your nails for the first time? This is the cleanest my hands have ever been. I don't have horse feces under them.
It's funny, my brother and I often reflect, our father would always just tackle projects. He was always trying to strip car engines and do these kind of things, and it really instilled in us a sense that these skills are something you can attain, and by breaking down what seems a very opaque or difficult concept like, you know, stripping a car engine, it kind of gives you an approach that you can learn these things, you can, you know, people can get their head around these skills, and why can't I? Did you find that was part of what you took away from that time in as a mechanic?
I don't think I ever really thought that there was nothing that I couldn't do. I kind of just got stuck in and nothing. Yeah, it didn't ever occur to me that I might not be able to do it, or that something might be too difficult. It did occur to me that I was building the brakes that were going to be used to stop the cars flying down Conrod when they're going around Bathurst, from 300 kilometers an hour down to 70 to make that last turn. But apart from that, it never really occurred to me that I couldn't do something. I just needed to make sure that whatever I did, that I was doing it following the instructions and to the best of my ability.
And Jess, out of sub-assembly and into something that you were probably a little bit more familiar with, marketing, media and PR, and you've previously said that social media in particular ground away on you in that particular role, and that you took it somewhat personally. Can you describe that and perhaps how you overcame that negativity?
I don't know if I've particularly overcome it, because it's not something that goes away. So I did, after I went to back to England, to Bournemouth, to study journalism, and I came back to Australia, I took on the role of media manager, which entailed, obviously, generating and overseeing the coverage of mainstream media, but also social media was really starting to take off in terms of Facebook pages, and Twitter was growing to its very small height that it reached in Australia. Instagram had just kind of kicked off and was gaining popularity. And combined with that, we had just signed with Red Bull in 2013 to become Red Bull Racing Australia, which was, given Red Bull, the global powerhouse that Red Bull is, was a massive amount of responsibility in terms of how we would receive publicly. And I think in terms of the negativity, we've seen over the last few years that it's rife in almost every aspect of life, and sport is particularly bad, and not only the sport of supercars or motor racing. But yeah, I take a fair bit of it personally, and I know I shouldn't, but I think that's because I'm probably more invested in the team than some other people. But I just have it still baffles me, and I struggle to comprehend how anybody can take the time out of their day to project negativity on someone else. I cannot wrap my head around that. Okay, if you think it, that's one thing, but how and why would you take the time to put that in writing? Which just shocks me. And I don't think that that's ever something that I'll fully come to terms with, which probably means that I'll never be able to completely combat the negativity of it. But it's just a case of avoiding it as much as I can. I'm not media manager these days, and I haven't been for a few years. So it means that I don't have to be directly involved in negativity that we do get on social media. But every so often, I do get it targeted to me personally. In which case, I've come up with my own ways of combating it, which usually involves pulling apart people's use of the English language. that's the best tool in my ammunition.
There's an ANU scholar, a guy called Michael Evans, who in one of his pieces refers to the internet as surely the biggest toilet wall in the history of the human race, which is pretty apt in this respect. It's a very insidious, the anonymity that people can hide behind by posting these ridiculous comments. And I think the fact that somehow people forget that these are real humans that they're talking about, and they think that through the medium of social media they can get away without either hurting someone's feelings and certainly without it catching up. It's a pretty insidious problem.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's especially easy to do with a sports team. We're seen as a big corporation. We're seen as, you know, because we've got the likes of Red Bull and Holden behind us, that we're almost depersonalized from it all, which isn't the case at all. There's a single person who's sitting there moderating these comments. That's not me these days, but it has been in the past. And I know that on the person who it is at the moment, it gets to her as well. It's hard to read any of that without it taking it personally to some degree, especially when you know how hard everyone in the team is trying to all achieve the same goal. And you know how much blood, sweat, and tears has gone into just turning the car around to get on track that weekend, let alone trying to get a result. And it reminds me of an open letter that Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who is the inventor of the internet, about how he feels the internet has changed since its inception. And he says that in the grand scheme of it, he thinks that at the moment it's going through its adolescent phase. It's currently a teenager, which is a very good way of putting it. I think it's going through that ugly phase at the moment where we don't quite know where it's going, what it's doing, or how it's behaving. And once it gets through that, and once people have learned how to control it, it will return to being a wonderfully useful and lucrative resource.
And of course, it seems that there's a gender part in this as well. We've certainly seen in some of the traditionally male-dominated sports the fantastic rise of female presence. And I'm referring now to AFLW as well. And concurrent with that, some of this trolling that's really aimed at the gender-based thing. Do you think the female part makes it a particularly more attractive target for these trolls?
I think that that's definitely been the case in things like AFLW. it's been really sad to see some of the stuff that has come out of that, and sad and positive though, because the outrage that has come from it and the recognition of how wrong some of this is has been, that's a mechanism for change. It's really sad that it happens in the first place, but if you can use it as a mechanism for change and a way to change attitudes, then I think that that is the positive that you take out of a negative situation. In motorsport specifically, I think we're very lucky in that although it comes across probably to those who haven't been involved in it directly as a very chauvinistic industry, not helped by the presence of grid girls and promotional models that have been rife over the years. That certainly doesn't help to anyone who's seeing it from the outside. But it's a very accepting industry. And once you're in, people don't care. People don't care what gender you are. Everybody is competing on an even playing field. And certainly there's one female driver in our category in supercars, Simona. And as far as I'm aware, nobody has ever given her any, nobody's ever targeted her in kind of mass, as you've seen in some of the other sports, for being a woman. And I think that's a fantastic thing about motorsport. And people, no matter what gender you are, no matter what age you are, genuinely want to see women succeed behind the wheel, because that shows that they've done it completely on an even playing field with the men.
It's very interesting you say that. Certainly one of the things when I first joined the SAS regiment, which, you know, the image is of a very male-dominated environment, and of course in many places that's true, but there was an absolute focus on performance. If you performed, it didn't matter your gender, it didn't matter your sexuality, your race, religion, creed, age, any of those sorts of things. It was a high-performance environment, and if you were doing whatever job you were employed to do, if you were doing it at the highest level you were capable of, then that was the metric by which you were measured. And it sounds probably a pretty similar thing in motorsport from what you're referring to.
Spot on. Even in roles such as being an engineer or a mechanic or a fabricator or a machinist, as long as you can do the job, nobody cares what as you say, what gender you are, what your sexuality is, what race you are. No one cares. Everyone's just interested in winning. And if you can contribute to that cause positively, then you're going to fit in.
So, Jess, before we leave the metaphoric toilet wall of social media, how would you respond to the skeptics, the critics that would reflect on where you are now and say, largely, it's been gifted to you?
There's every so often that does pop up. Ignorantly, I sometimes get a laugh from reading some of the comments every time if there's an article that pops up about me. And luckily I can laugh at a lot of them. Ironically, I take the stuff that is aimed personally at me less personally than the stuff that is aimed at the team. But for those who do believe that I'm chairman of the Australian Women in Motorsport Commission so that my father can have an extra hand in CAMS, which is the national governing body of motorsport in Australia, that just made me laugh. I know in my heart of hearts that I have got to where I am because I have worked hard and I deserve to be here. And the other thing that I always remind myself is that anybody who knows my father will know that I would have never just been given a job for the sake of giving his daughter a job. There's anybody who he comes down harder on in the business than anyone else, it's me.
You probably had to work even harder than an outsider might have.
I don't know if I would have had to work harder, but certainly the expectations are higher on me than they are on many other people. When I was media manager, for example, if I sent out a press release with one typo or a missing comma or something like that, he was straight on to me like a ton of bricks for the smallest mistake, whereas everybody who's been media manager since me, he doesn't even notice. I'm not sure he even reads the press releases sometimes. That's just an example, but certainly anybody who knows him would know that I would have never been gifted anything with ease in my life.
Tim and I love a good quote. We've reflected on this often. And in fact, we've made an entire podcast based on stealing other people's great ideas and of course, yours included now. But my brother's particularly fond of the Roosevelt man in the arena, obviously, you know, person in the arena, if we take it that way. But it's not the critic who counts. And it sounds like you're applying that methodology in terms of the various bits of criticism that crop up every now and then.
Yeah, I don't think I'm intentionally employing any methodology. It's just what comes most naturally to me. And then as I read more and as I learn more, as I always try to do, trying to just think which bits can apply to me and how can I best use them to affect my everyday life in a positive way.
Yeah, sift and filter, select the things that are important and ignore the rest. So we want to come back to women in motorsport, Jess, but perhaps before we do that, let's talk about the business of motorsports. And one of the interesting things, years ago, I met Tony Cochran, probably 2010, and he had come out of International Management Group and had bought what was then called the Australian Touring Car Championship in 1996 for about $52,000, renamed V8 Supercars. And he sold it to Archer Capital in 2011, so a couple of years after we met, for $330 million. We actually sat down during one of the V8 supercar series, the Abu Dhabi race, talking about what he'd done to turn around what was dying in Australian touring cars into the success of V8 supercars. And he told me that he sought some advice from Bernie Eccleston. And what Bernie Eccleston had said is own your own vision. That's own your own television rights and sell those and make sure that teams get ownership in the franchise. And I understand that there's about 26 teams that own some 35% stake in V8 supercars. What's your theory on, at the macro level, V8 supercars, the business of motorsports?
It's a really interesting space to be in at the moment, to be honest. I think any sports management is going through a period of change and evolution that is largely tied into broadcast and how people consume the sports. So it's funny that it's taken from Bernie Eccleston, because he turned Formula One into what it is through this model of owning and selling broadcast rights. However, one of the reasons that Liberty now owns Formula One is because there is so much change going on in that sphere. And if you look at how Liberty, which, you know, there are many other sports around the world doing it, I think if you take UFC, Formula One, they're examples of sports that are really challenging the traditional models of sports distribution. And what we're seeing now, especially with Liberty taking over Formula One, is they'll gradually be not buying back, but not renewing the traditional broadcast rights packages that they've been selling off for the last few decades. They'll be holding, rights holders will start holding on to broadcast rights themselves, and it will become much more self-contained as viewership moves more to an internet-based model. So for example, Liberty, I think, are looking at a model that they've already started rolling it out, which is a pay-per-view model. So you can either you can stream through the internet a whole season worth, or you can choose a certain number of races and tune in for what works out as $5 a race. Now, using that model, the numbers are showing that the viewership will go down considerably, but the revenue will go up, which is quite an interesting way of looking at it. You know, they're trying to keep up the revenue, even though they're risking losing fans, with the aim of the model eventually regaining all those fans as all TV and entertainment moves into that internet-based area. So it's a really interesting time, largely driven by broadcast. And for supercars, it's been well publicised that the media deal that we currently have with Fox Sports and Ten is up at the end of 2020, And that'll be really interesting to see what happens there, and how that evolves, and how supercars can continue to own and be groundbreaking and path leading in the ways that we produce our content and engage with our fans. The other factor to consider in this evolution of broadcast is the fact that audiences are changing. Audiences getting older, sports need to target younger people, and the way that young people consume their entertainment is vastly different to how a generation or two generations older consume theirs. So anybody who says that they know what's going to be happening in the space of TV and sports and entertainment and broadcast consumption over the next 5, 10, 15 years, anybody who says that they know what that's going to look like is probably a liar.
Turning our attention to the team, 888 Race Engineering, RD sold some shares in 2015, and you've already mentioned that you bought some, you hold some equity in the team. What's the business structure and the outlook? So you've bought in on the vision. What is the vision?
Ah, good question. The vision is in the short term to win as many races, championships and Bathurst 1000s as we can. As it always has been. And in the long term, it's quite fluid. I wouldn't say that RD, who is still, by the way, he's still the controlling majority. So he's very much in charge, and the other shareholders, there's five shareholders in total, and the other four of us, you know, we sit back and let them steer the ship very much. It's quite fluid. He looks ahead in terms of making sure that he's got a succession plan in place in case he gets hit by a bus tomorrow. His plan is always to make sure that if anything were to happen, nobody would lose their jobs tomorrow if it were to happen. Mm. Things like Jamie Winkup, who is anybody who's a sports fan will hopefully know that he's the most successful Australian touring car driver in history, 7 championships, almost 120 race wins, just in a league of his own in terms of the stats. But he's been with us since 2006 and bought into the team last year. So bought a 20% stake in the team last year. And that vision is really to make sure that, or sorry, the purpose of that was, in terms of vision, is to make sure that there is somebody who can fill RD's shoes from a motorsport perspective. I mean, all the shareholders in the group, some of whom wouldn't be, you know, a couple of whom they're part of the shareholder group because they love motorsport and believe in what 888 does, not because they want to come in and run the business. Whereas Jamie has bought into the team with the view of, in some capacity, running the business one day and taking some share of what RD currently does. I've always thought that nobody can fully take on what he does because there are very few people who have a brain that works like his does. And I think most people probably acknowledge that, and within the shareholder group are well aware that nobody will ever be able to completely replace everything that he does. So it's important within the shareholder group and within the people who he sees as taking over the team in probably in the very far distant future, who still, you know, is 63 or something. So he's got a bit of time ahead, especially if you look at the likes of Roger Penske. He's still going strong. So I think he's bringing other people up in the team who aren't necessarily shareholders, but who he sees will be influential in the team in years to come, and making sure that somehow all of the bases that he has covered will be covered between this group of people.
Mm. And this is an elite team, arguably a high performance team. Can we talk leadership? You've got some athletes who clearly are the highest profile members of the team, but then you've got technicians and analysts and mechanics and the commercial component as well. How does leadership play out in a team environment like that?
That's a good question, because RD's style of leadership is very unique. And the more that I read and consume on the topic, the more I can see that it is unique. And it has worked very effectively both here and in the UK and in different businesses and in different forms of motorsport. But I think as we look into the future and we look at the group who RD foresees as people who will be influential that we were just talking about, that style of leadership can't really be replicated exactly. You have to be a very unique type of person and a type of leader to be able to make that style of leadership effective, because it is very, it's authority. I don't want to say it's not a dictatorship by any means.
A benevolent dictatorship.
Authoritarian. And it's very much this is the view, this is how I see it happening, and this is what's going to work. Fortunately for him, so far he hasn't gone too far wrong. You know, we're however many championships and Bathurst 1000 wins in, and it's been gone pretty well. But in terms of managing the team that we currently have, it's really interesting because there are so many diverse characters and many different departments, and there are key pillars that RD calls them, key pillars of success, that include things like looking after the good people, and if there's somebody in the team who doesn't who is underperforming, then make sure that you're not wasting energy on keeping them if you don't feel like they're going to contribute to the long term. Things like making sure that it's not just the people who are in the team who you're looking after their families as well. I'd like to think that everyone at 888 believes that both them as employees and their families are part of the team, and that's certainly the culture that we've tried to instill. And win and lose together as a group. Sometimes the biggest celebrations that we've had have been after a loss. In fact, celebration is the wrong word, but some of the biggest nights, some of the best team building activities that we've done have been after we've had a tremendous loss, and not come out of the race weekend having done the best that we could. And sometimes that's when it's most important to bring everyone together and remind everyone that we're working towards the same goal and that we need to do it together. I think back to 2016 when for the category, it was a fantastic start to the year. We had 10 different race winners across 7 races or something like that. So it was fantastic on paper, but that's not fantastic for us. We want to win. So halfway, I think it was after Winton, we had an absolute shocker at Winton. And so we took the whole team karting. We took the afternoon off work, went to a kart venue and spent a good 3 hours tearing around the track and bashing each other up in go-karts, which is, you know, if you're in a race team, that's everyone's idea of fun. I went out for a bit of food and a couple of drinks afterwards. And from that moment on, we went to Darwin, I think it was, and we won the championship with a 1-2.
Yeah, success is often a very poor teacher. In fact, I'd say commonly the poorest teacher. Failure is the ultimate teacher. So into the driver's seat, how much do the drivers lead the team? How much influence do they have in a leadership perspective?
That's an interesting one, because they're all very different personalities. And they all, so even though Craig Lowndes doesn't drive full time anymore, he's still very much part of the team. We call him a team ambassador, but you know, he's more than that, really. Although he's not a shareholder of the team, unlike Jamie, and that's through a choice of his own. He's always said he doesn't want to be involved in team ownership. I would say he's a very influential leader of the team because he's been part of the team for such a long time. He joined us in 2005, and we have 888 and Craig, who joined us out of a very difficult patch in his career, really grew together. And even though I don't think he doesn't intend to be a leader of the team per se, people look to him as a leader of the team because he does have that really long established relationship with so many people in the team, and we've been through so much together. Jamie naturally has taken on a leadership role himself through his through buying into the team, but that's more into the future. In terms of his leadership currently, he's within his small team around him, so his race engineer, his data engineer, his mechanics, he's he's a very good leader of that small team because he's a driver and an encourager of change and progression and evolution. And in motorsport, especially when you're going through a difficult patch, as we are at the moment, where we're not performing as well as we should be, we're not winning. That's really important. And then you've got Shane van Gisbergen, who has only been with the team since 2016, so still relatively new with the team in terms of the drivers' lifespans with us. And I don't think he wants to be seen as a leader. He probably doesn't want to be. All he thinks about is getting in the car and driving as fast as he can. Mm. I think, similar to Jamie, he probably is a leader within his own small team, but it's probably his friendships within the team. He's got fantastic friendships in the team, and he has some very, very good relationships within his group, within the team, that make him a leader, even if he doesn't necessarily want to be one.
Jess, you spoke before about your role as chair of the Australian Women in Motorsport Commission, and I've noticed that separately you've listed one of your favourite movies as Mean Girls, which struck a chord with me. I've had a female colleague refer to female interactions in the business environment as very much like that movie. You know, in many cases, it's not very supportive and there's a real sort of friction in a lot of quarters. Have you found that in terms of the gender relationships, you know, between females within your industry?
No, I don't think so. I can see how it would be. I don't have much experience of business in a non-male dominated environment, to be completely honest. I've worked in predominantly male dominated environments for most of my adult life. So yeah, I can see how that might be, but I don't have first-hand experience of that.
Sure.
In terms of within motorsport, I think because women in motorsport still isn't that commonplace. It's not unusual, but it's not commonplace. It's not a given yet. And so I think that leads women within motorsport to support each other and have to look out for each other and to not go down the route of that kind of mean girls environment. But on the topic of mean girls, I think if you know, it's one thing watching it when you're a teenager, but then as you get older, you can learn from Tina Fey, who wrote it, who is actually getting some very important life lessons through some thoroughly entertaining movie time.
I think there's a semi-autobiographical element if you read Bossy Pants, Tina Fey's book, which is a fantastic treatise on, I think, leadership in general, but, you know, her take on the gender relationship in the entertainment industry. I reckon there's some, like you say, there's some very thinly veiled life lessons in a very entertaining movie. Jess, you've mentioned that one of your goals within the commission is to look at developing a better understanding of why gender disparity exists. Have you got any ideas in that respect as to why it is a factor in motorsport?
Yeah, I think that there are several elements to it. And I won't go into them all now, but the biggest ones stem from grassroots. And it's not, we're not just talking about driving here. We're talking about women involved in engineering as mechanics and all the other areas that we touched upon previously. And that on the whole, there is a limited size bubble of STEM involvement in Australia. And within that bubble, a very small fraction of women are involved in those STEM subjects and STEM industries. So it's a case of taking it right back to even when children are 4 years old. If you think about, to give you an example, you've got 2 4-year-olds, a boy and a girl. What do you give the boy for his fourth birthday? You'll give him a car or some Lego or something that involves him using certain cognitive skills to solve a problem. What do you give a girl? Probably give her a Barbie or a doll or something to put together a kitchen with. Those things don't teach her problem-solving skills. And that automatically puts girls on the back foot when it comes time to go to school and start learning maths and science and these subjects that involve problem solving. And naturally, if you're not good at something, you start to not like it. And for many girls, it's fantastic that they can get over that. And it is great that that some girls, it doesn't affect some girls, they're naturally good at science and maths. But for me personally, I can speak from experience. I didn't have many problem solving toys as a kid. I was very good at literature skills, but I didn't persevere with maths or science because I found it too hard, and that was intimidating for me. And I never, unfortunately, I didn't realize until I was older that actually it would have been amazing to study engineering and be able to be a race engineer. But nobody at a younger age had ever said to me, oh, if you do want to do engineering, you should probably persevere with maths and science because that's what's going to get you there. So if you can start from a young age, from, you know, you're talking very young, but as you work older, get older to the ages that we can influence more easily, between the ages of kind of 8 to 18, it's showing these girls how they can get involved, or the benefits to remaining involved in these STEM subjects and what opportunities are available to them if they keep pursuing them.
Hmm. Okay, Jess, we're getting into the serious stuff now. Out of the garage and into the gym, and you are an avid CrossFitter.
Try to be.
And on this end, we have two people who have muddled their way through CrossFit. Although Ben talks about his competing in what were then called sectionals, which shows that he's about 108 years old.
Well, actually, I went to regionals. Full disclosure, Tim is sharing the studio with a regionals athlete, which I like to rub in. In fairness, Tim is correct. This was before anyone could spell CrossFit. We'd been exposed to it through the US military in its infancy. And so a colleague of mine, a guy called Mark Wales, and I sort of trained up, and we made it across the regionals.
Was that in the era where you just nominated to go to regionals? And
No. We went through a grueling sectionals test and got across.
But anyway, enough about you, Jess.
Well, I will reflect in the interest of full disclosure that we did a deadlift event, and the deadlift weight was 120 kilograms. I then remember a couple of years later looking at a regionals clean event, and the clean weight was 120 kilograms. So it was very much a different CrossFit to what you're probably competing and enjoying at the moment, Jess.
Jess, importance of staying fit.
Yeah, it's massively important, and I'm realizing now that it's now that I'm back studying, I'm realizing that it's important from a mental health perspective as well. Because if I'm sitting here studying all day and I don't have an opportunity to get out and vent some of my energy, or a chance to clear my brain, or a chance to just let everything that I've learned that day soak in, it has a massive impact upon my ability to concentrate and also just feel healthy and feel good about myself. So I'm appreciating it now from a mental health point of view as well as a physical health point of view.
Most disliked CrossFit workout?
Oh, anything with wall balls and thrusters, which are basically the same thing, only one of the things hits you in the face on the way down.
For Tim, that's the thruster.
And favourite CrossFit workout?
Oh, anything with snatches or power cleans, probably.
Impressive.
Yeah, barbells, that's what... People just love throwing around barbells, don't they? That's why most people do CrossFit. All the extra stuff is just pain.
I never loved lifting them, but I like dropping them.
yeah, that too, it's quite satisfying.
Jess, we take our title of our show from a Rudyard Kipling poem called If. Is this poem something you were familiar with growing up or in your earlier years?
No, I can't say I studied Kipling very closely. I wouldn't say I didn't study it at all, but or study him at all. But no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that it was something that that I was particularly familiar with before coming across your podcast. And naturally, I read the background on it.
Yeah. There's one particular line from this poem that I'd really like to get your reflections on. It seems to me you would deal with a whole range of people in through motorsport, you know, fans, investors, drivers, mechanics, you know, all of the stakeholders, let alone the sort of media side of things as well. And there's a line in If that I'd like to run by you and get your thoughts. The line is, "If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch." What does that mean to you in the context of your life, Jess? Do you find you have to change your approach through your interaction with all the different stakeholders that you deal with?
Oh, I think everybody has to change something about themselves when dealing with different individuals, because you can't approach everybody in the same way. Everybody is individual, and therefore they deserve their own individual treatment, if that makes sense. But certainly, yes, dealing with different stakeholders and different various people who you come across in any industry, you shouldn't change what you fundamentally believe in your personal ethics and morals, but this kind of surface level of your interactions with them should be tailored to each individual. And I think that that shows respect to each individual that you deal with.
And Jess, is there any piece of literature, book, poem that you would reach for if you wanted some reassurance or to be inspired?
I should probably avoid saying Harry Potter, shouldn't I? That probably would be
not at all.
There are just so many life lessons from Albus Dumbledore though. But I've read some fantastic books recently, and I think it's fiction, but I absolutely loved it, and it's called The Art of Racing in the Rain. And I loved it because it's about motorsport and it's written from the point of view of a dog. But if you look past that, there are some fantastic life lessons about forgiveness and about rising above something, about rising above adversity and working towards the greater good. From a non-fiction point of view, I read Factfulness. I don't know if anybody's ever, if you've ever heard of that or if anybody's ever recommended it, but although it gets a little bit repetitive, the premise of it is that the world is not as bad as some might, as it's portrayed essentially, and how it comes across in the media. And Factfulness, if you're ever feeling like the world is doom and gloom, I think Factfulness is a great one to reach for. And in terms of poetry, I reach for anything written by my grandmother.
Oh, wow. That's great.
She's not a published author or anything like that, but she loves writing, but she can only write in rhyme.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Jess, thank you very much for being on the podcast. It's been tremendous to get your insights.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks very much. It's been great.
Cheers.
Thanks, Jess.
Real challenge. It's win or lose, isn't it? You know, even second place is kind of not quite good enough.
First loser, according to Ricky Bobby. Have you seen that Talladega Nights?
If you're not first, you're last. Yeah.
All right, back to the books for you, Jess.
Yeah, keep learning about negligence. Great fun.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers.